Yes, hello and good day. You are tuned into Warning Shots here on CKUW 95.9 FM. Warning Shots is CKUW's independent international news show. And CKUW is your listener-driven radio station on the FM dial in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Scott Price. Today is February the 22nd, 2013. And on today's show, I'll be talking with Roger Annis. He'll be live on the phone with us. He's the coordinator for the Canada-Haiti Action Network. And mostly out of its Vancouver affiliate and Haiti Solidarity BC. So he will be live on the phone to talk about the situation in Mali and the context there, and as well as the parallels to Haiti. And so stay tuned for all that, because Roger Annis, he's written a couple articles that have gone on rabble.ca and like that, and they've been very good articles for sort of giving the fuller context to some of this stuff. And of course, some of these issues I have already covered in the show, but we're going to go a bit more in depth and have a discussion today with Roger. So stay tuned for that. And of course, your international news in brief will be coming up as well, as always. But, just a couple of housekeeping announcements and things like that, and we can get on to the show. So, as you well know, Fun Drive wrapped up last Friday, which seems already like a long time ago. It was a busy week for me, but thanks to your generous donations for Fun Drive 2013, it was actually the most successful Fun Drive yet because of those donations. CKW raised $57,518, which is amazing. You helped us make history, because that was more than our previous record of Fun Drive pledging, which was $56,030. So thank you so much again, and thank you so much for everyone that that pledged to my show as well as every other show. And your support truly means the world to me, as well as the staff and my fellow volunteers. So thank you, the listeners who supported us and who continue to listen and keep the little station that could CKW going for another year. So thank you for the continued support. And it really makes what people do here. I don't get paid to do this. I do this out of the love of doing it. And those contributions, when people stepped up to the plate and gave their money, it really means a lot. So thank you again. Now, for the pledge payment, there's a bit of a different thing going on this year. So for payment and incentive pickup, it has moved to the UW bookstore in the annex. That's the old Greyhound bus terminal. So if you go to there's a couple ways you can access this. If you go off of Memorial, it'll be on the right, and it's just kind of before that hotel that's on the corner of Portage and Memorial. So it's just kind of right before that. You'll see there's a parking lot there. You can park there and then kind of go in and find the bookstore, and you can talk to Tim as well. You can, if you want, you can walk in through on the other side, which is Balmoral, I believe. You can walk in through where there's sort of the bus loop, and you can get in through there as well. So the hours of operation are Monday to Friday, 9:30 a.m. to 5 p.m., and Saturdays, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. So that's a bit of a different, bit of a change from a usual place at the info booth, but that is where you can do that. So thank you. And then, be sure to pick up those incentives. I'll quickly give a quick shout out and thank you to both Fernwood Publishing and Arbiter Ring, who gave books to the show, as well as donated books for incentives for Warning Shots. So thank you very much to those great local publishers. So thank you very much for all of that. That's housekeeping. Now let's take a look at some of the news that's happening around the world right now. So here's just some of the news happening around the world right now. Weekly news update on the Americas reports Industrial Global Union, a European industrial union federation founded in Copenhagen on June the 19th, 2012, is calling for mobilizations, awareness-raising activities, and letter writing between February the 18th and 24th to protest labor violations in Mexico, with a special focus on the Finnish-based auto parts multinational PKC Group. In December, the company's Mexican subsidiary laid off 122 workers from its three plants in northern Mexico, near the border of Texas. All the members of the militant union's local executive committee were among those dismissed, and the rest were thought to be supporters of the local. The company, PKC, has signed a contract with what the laid-off workers described as a company union. With more than 5,000 employees, the three PKC plants are among the area's most important tax-exempt assembly plants producing for export. The majority of the workers are women, many of them single mothers, and most make about $8 a day, U.S., for an 8-hour day. Although the European sources give a higher wage of $55 a week. As in the rest of this area along the U.S. border, most of the plants are generally non-union. Only 3 of the 60 were unionized as of 2012. AllAfrica.com reports the Sudanese army spokesman refuted once more the allegations that by the Justice and Equality Movement, saying that the presence of Malayan insurgents in Darfur. Meanwhile, the rebels argue that they have pictures that prove their claim. The Sudanese army spokesman maintains the rebel movement's intention is to mislead the international community and portray Khartoum as a safe harbor and supporter of terrorism and extreme elements. The rebel spokesman insists that the rebel fighters are present in several areas of North Darfur, adding their pictures have been taken in areas in Darfur. Now, the rebel spokesman says the government is trying to hide the Malayans by dissolving them into the Central Reserve Force, also known as the Abu Terra. He noted that the Abu Terra have been used in Darfur, in the Libyan War, and in Mali. And the BBC reports a protester who was struck in the head by a tear gas canister fired by police in Bahrain last week has died. Named Mahmoud Al-Jaziri, who's 20, died in hospital on Friday, 7 days after being injured, according to a statement released today. Mr. Al-Jaziri is the third person to be killed during anti-government protests in Bahrain in the last week. Violence flared during demonstrations marking 2 years of protest. Another member of Mr. Al-Jaziri's family was shot and killed by police, and a police officer died after being attacked during unrest on the 14th of February. The anniversary of the occupation of Pearl Roundabout in the capital by pro-democracy activists. And that is just some of the news happening around the world right now. Do stay tuned. I will have Roger Annis on the phone in a little bit. So do stay tuned. This is Warning Shots on CKUW 95.9 FM.
Down the masters. The backcountry learned of ratification. The people had a coffin painted black. Solemnly born in funeral procession. They buried it deep in the earth as an emblem of the dissolution.
And we are back.
And try your call again. Oh. This is a recording.
Hello, Roger, are you there?
Sorry, your call did not... Will you please...
Okay, problem with the phone line. Hold on, let me... Technical difficulties. Let me just try to reconnect with Roger here. We'll be back in a second.
Many journeys require a road map or a guide to lead you to your goal. If you're finding your jazz voyage a little confusing, why not let Keith Black be your guru every Wednesday at 10 a.m. for a three-hour voyage through yesterday, today, and tomorrow's music. That's Voyage on CKUW.
Government conspiracy, medical mysteries, the paranormal, extraterrestrials, lost civilizations, mythical beings, magic and shamanism, unexplained phenomena. On Here There Be Dragons, we explore these and other zones within the cosmic mystery we inhabit. Our channel is the medium of radio. So hop aboard our vessel and prepare to chart a course for the great unknown every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock. That's Here There Be Dragons, right here on CKUW 95.9 FM.
And we are back.
Your call did not go through. Will you please hang up and try your call again? Is a record.
Hello, Roger? Oh, hold on a second.
Why is it doing this?
Hello, Roger, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay, sorry, just a bit of a mix-up there with the phones. Well, thank you very much for coming on, Roger. So just to introduce you to the audience here, so Roger Annis is the coordinator for the Canada-Haiti Action Network, and you've been doing a lot of research on Mali and as well as its connections to Haiti. So, and you've been published in rabble.ca. There's a couple great articles that they have published. So thank you very much for coming on to talk about this situation in Mali.
Oh, you're welcome. It's good to be with you.
Yes. Now, let's start by going back a bit before this intervention, because I think this is an important point for the context. Explain the role that sort of there was French special forces in Mali before the intervention, as well as the aid that Mali was given essentially to fight, as they say, counterterrorism, counter-narcotics. So talk about all of that whole context before this formal intervention.
Sure. I think the most important backdrop to the events in Mali is the rush for resources in Africa that's been going on for a couple of decades. It's really a recolonization of Africa that's been going on. There was a remarkable column by the Globe and Mail columnist Doug Saunders 2 weeks ago where he described events in Africa over the past couple of decades as a new form of colonialism. Quite remarkable to see that in the pages of the Globe and Mail. Canadian mining investments, for mm-hmm. example, in Mali have gone from $6 billion. Sorry, in Africa have gone from $6 billion in the year 2005 to $32 billion in 2011. And you know, this is just one country. The rest of Europe and North America and Australia and China—they're all piling into Africa. So this has been going on for some time now. And then parallel with this, a bit more recently, has been a U.S.-led drive to militarize the different parts of Africa where there's important resources. And in the case of West Africa, this began in 2005. The U.S. Created what they call the Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Partnership, and they brought 10 of the countries that are neighboring to Mali, including Mali itself, into this military partnership, so-called, to essentially safeguard imperial interests in the continent. And so Mali has been very much a staging ground for this intense militarization drive. It's been led by the United States, but of course France, Britain, other European powers have been front and center in this, and then a bit more recently Canada. Pretty tragic overall when you consider the poverty, the climate-induced crisis in food production that's deepening in Africa, the public health emergencies that are going on. So to see all of this money being spent on militarization of the West African region and the continent as a whole is really quite an affront to you know, to basic human dignity and morality.
Now, in one of your articles for Rabble, you talked about how it seems as though, or there's some inkling that Mali was already on the priority list for the new French government, which is, you know, the new government, which is essentially a left-wing government, but that Mali was sort of on their foreign policy priority list, right?
That's right. In fact, Mali's been central to the developments in West Africa over the past 10 years. Three of the past 6 years, there's an annual military exercise of this Trans-Saharan Partnership. And so Mali has been the host country of this annual military exercise for three of the past 6 years. Now, last year's exercise, they call it Operation Flintlock, was canceled in Mali because of the coup d'etat in March of last year. But yeah, it's been absolutely central to this and to French foreign policy. France is the former colonial power of Mali and of the other neighboring countries there, so it's been pretty central. And what was made quite remarkably clear in an article published in one of the French, one of the daily newspapers in France called Le Nouvel Observateur, was a blow-by-blow account of how, beginning with the events in early last year, 2012, in Mali, the country went right to the top of foreign policy concerns of the French government, and this very much deepened after the election of François Hollande and the Socialist Party government in France in May of last year. So, yeah, it's been at the top of the pile, to use a phrase that was in the journalist's article of French foreign policy concerns, and what their article in Le Nouvel Observateur describes is a step-by-step a process of France preparing the military intervention into Mali that it launched on January 11th of this year, last month.
Now, I think that's great for the listeners to get that sort of context and background to what's going on here. Now, the question, though, is interesting because there seems to be a differencing of opinion that I've noticed in some reports on this. You know, I mean, there's the one thing where it's sort of, you know, we're fighting the good fight against the Islamic terrorists in the north. I mean, there's that, but there's also the more critical position of it. But there seems to be a kind of a differencing of opinion because, you know, some people point out, well, you know, like you said, all this military aid and stuff to the government in Mali, and there's huge connections there. But at the same time, so hence that is sort of that's what caused this instability of the army in Mali carrying out the coup. So then this is sort of blowback, right? But then there's other people that say, well, no, these Al Qaeda forces have connections to the Western governments. And then, and that this is there's a bigger connection, and that this is somehow maybe some way planned or at least fostered by the United by Western powers. So there seems to be this differencing of opinion sometimes. With is it blowback? Is it more something that's that was more thoughtful in how why this thing in Mali happened? What's your take on that?
I think there's a lot of uncontrolled forces that have been set in motion in Mali and in the region. I think that's the story above all. In the particular case of Mali, it's a restive people. The Malian people fought for their independence against France. They fought for their national sovereignty. They've had, you know, progressive governments at various moments since their independence in 1960. So the Malian people are not at all happy or content with the poverty that they live under, a poverty that's created by the structures of international capital. It's reinforced by how foreign aid operates, and more recently, as I mentioned, the militarization of the region. So you've got that. But then you have a very unique situation in the north of the country, with the Tuareg and other national minorities who have never really accepted these national borders that are essentially the product of the colonial era. They never accepted that the people in the North never accepted that they would be sort of willing partners of a Mali government. That all depends on what the government could deliver to them, and it hasn't delivered much of anything at all. And so there's been quite a long struggle in the north of Mali for the Tuareg people in particular, but other national minorities, to have some form of political autonomy or even independence. And this has been going on for decades. The Tuareg people, their traditional homeland encompasses five countries in the region: Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, Libya, and Algeria. So for them, that's their homeland. It's not these countries called Mali, Niger, and so forth. So they have been fighting this fight, and in fact, in the neighboring country of Niger, the struggle of the Tuareg has been even more intense over the years. They scored some victories in this front last year in northern Mali. The Tuareg forces defeated the Malian government, which had been on this years-long effort to essentially retake some rights of political, cultural, and economic autonomy that the Tuaregs had won from previous governments. And so the Malian government was defeated by the Tuaregs last year. Unfortunately, then, the Islamic fundamentalist forces, with a lot of heavy arms, a lot of financing, moved into the north of the country. There's not that many of them that were indigenous to the north, and they essentially pushed aside the traditional Tuareg political leadership, in particular the National Movement for the Liberation of Azawad. Azawad is the name that the Tuareg give to the homeland that they aspire to have. So this has been a very destructive thing for the Tuareg and for the rest of Mali, and this was really the pretext, this movement of the fundamentalist forces into the north of Mali was the pretext that France used to justify its intervention. I call it a pretext because, you know, France's concern is not simply with the Islamic fundamentalist forces, as important an issue as that might be to French foreign policy, but France has been opposed to this autonomy struggle of the Tuareg. And so, the exact relationship of these Islamic fundamentalist forces to the United States, to the Algerian government and secret police, to some of the reactionary regimes in the Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, is a subject that some people are studying in some depth now, including Jeremy Keenan, who published an article in the New Internationalist magazine in December of last year that looked at this. That's still a story, I think, to be told. I don't think that whatever influence the U.S. may have, France in all this, possibly Algeria, I don't think it was a matter of them sort of orchestrating an entry of the fundamentalist forces into the north of Mali. I don't think the story is that sort of simple and straightforward. They've been cultivating to some degree relations with this, including through the ties that bind the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia to the United States. So that exact story, I think, has yet to be told. I think probably that, you know, what's happened in Mali is that, you know, things have kind of gotten out of, can't be controlled entirely and have gotten out of control. And so the U.S., France, and their allies find themselves with a really kind of a multiple-layered political crisis in Mali that they're going to be very hard-pressed to resolve.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, we'll get back to, like you talked about, France and Niger and the kind of the neighboring countries. We'll get to that in a minute, but I think another thing we should talk about is these reports of the ethnic cleansing of the Tuareg in northern Mali by the government, by the army. So can you elaborate on this and these reports?
Yeah, it's very concerning. I mentioned the battle that had been going on between the Tuareg and the Malian army for some years. Well, you know, the Malian army was in the north of Mali perpetrating human rights violations against the Tuareg and other national minorities in an attempt to quash their aspirations for autonomy, if not political independence. So this is not a new story. And when France announced and conducted its rapid intervention in January, the warning bells went off right away from the Tuareg movements. They were very concerned that the Malian army would now come back into the north of the country, and that they, the Tuareg, would not have the same means to defend themselves as they did before. And sure enough, every major human rights organization that's looked at the conditions in North Mali following the French intervention have raised serious concerns about reprisals being carried out against the Tuareg and the other national minorities. So Amnesty International has reported on this. Human Rights Watch, FIDA, which is a human rights organization based in France, although it's an international organization. And there's been some media reporting on this, although the media reporting has sadly and really ashamedly been quite limited. The one really substantial report was published in The Telegraph, one of Britain's leading dailies. They managed to get a reporter to go to Timbuktu, which is kind of in the southern part of the north of Mali, a very, of course, historic city. And he reported in on February 7th in The Telegraph that the Tuareg and Arabs had been driven out of Timbuktu, had been essentially, you know, sent out into the desert to survive in the days preceding and then after the arrival of the French and Malian forces. So very, very serious and ongoing concerns around human rights. There's still hundreds of thousands of people living in refugee camps, either in Mali, in the north of Mali, or in the neighboring countries, who are the victims of the war that the Malian army was conducting against the people of the north prior to their defeat in 2012. So this is, you know, disturbingly a really untold part of the story of what's been taking place, and I'm very anxious to see more journalists who can get into the north of Mali, and also the human rights organizations get back into there and tell us more of the story there, and to apply the necessary pressure that's needed to prevent the Malian army and its French masters from perpetrating serious human rights violations against the people there.
Yeah, now on that same line as well, you've pointed out that there's been the blocking of journalists to northern Mali by France.
That's right. This has been reported in French media, and I've seen it in Le Monde and some of the other French dailies, so it's an established fact. And in fact, when you go looking for news of Mali in either in English or in French, you note the relatively small number of reports that are coming from the north of Mali itself. And so that's a double sort of confirmation of what the French press has been reporting. Is actually very few journalists that are getting into the northern Mali and reporting what they see. Now, there has been some reporting, and I looked at some reports that were on French television, for example, video reports of the some of the human rights concerns that I mentioned earlier. So it's been happening, but it's pretty limited. And I noted that here in Canada, our national broadcaster has not... The only report from the north of Mali that I've seen or heard on the CBC has been from an embedded journalist traveling with the French army. So that's the only, as we know from Iraq and then Afghanistan, you know, embedded journalism, it's apparently the only way in which Canadian reporters have gone into to Mali. And I noted that in the CBC reporting, and I believe it was Margaret Evans who was accompanying the French, they don't even sort of provide the proviso anymore that, oh, by the way, this is an embedded journalist. They just kind of take it as fact that the listener will accept that embedded journalism is okay, so they don't even bother to say, oh, by the way, this is an embedded report with, you know, that's gone through the French censorship. So our reporting in Canada has been particularly weak on this, despite the deep involvement of our own government in the events in Mali.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's and in a minute we'll still have to touch on the neighboring countries. But you just brought up Canada's involvement. What do you take on? I mean, I had Derek O'Keefe from Rabble on to talk about Mali, but also we talked about sort of the lack of any kind of substantial debate at all in this last decade on foreign policy. I mean, Afghanistan, there was really no debate. Libya, there was no real debate on that at all. There's really no debate on Mali either. And it's very interesting to see that even in the case of Libya and Mali, the NDP party, which would be normally you would think the most, you know, apt to perhaps speaking out or having more of a critical view or at least pushing for a conversation about what the missions should look like, what should Canada's role be, there's none of that. What do you make of all that as well? I mean, there is a definite silence here in Canada.
Yeah, well, I think it's pretty unfortunate, shameful, really. I've been following the transcripts of the discussions of the Foreign Affairs Committee of Parliament in Ottawa on Mali. They've had four or five formal discussions on the Foreign Affairs Committee since the intervention, and there's no hint of any disagreement or questioning of the intervention there among any of the parties in Ottawa. So that's pretty disturbing. It's really a continuation of a trend with Haiti. Haiti's received the same degree of critical attention, and no disagreement or dissidence from government policy either. So it's disturbing because Canada's been backing the French intervention and has been part of the militarization that I've talked about as well. So pretty concerning, and I think Canadians deserve much better from our elected members of Parliament in critically supervising and examining and even proposing alternatives to the foreign policy of this present government.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's get to France's involvement in Niger. Now, I believe that there's significant involvement there as well as around uranium mines. So could you talk about that situation and how it affects Mali?
Yeah, I think there's two big things that motivated France's intervention. One is the, you know, what they would call the instability, the political instability in Mali caused by the Tuareg rebellion. But the other thing is Niger. France gets something like 75% of its electrical energy from its nuclear reactor stations. And lo and behold, virtually all of the uranium that feeds France's nuclear reactors comes from Niger. Niger is one of the large uranium-producing countries of the world, and the big French multinational called Areva owns mines in Niger. In fact, they're building presently a uranium mine that will be the second largest uranium mine in the world when completed. So the uranium mines in Niger are a lifeline to France's capitalist economy. And so that's been the other big motivator in the French intervention to make sure that it keeps its tight grip over the country of Niger and its uranium mines. And then Niger, like Mali, is one of the poorest countries of the world. So these uranium mines in Niger, just like the gold mines that are in the south of Mali, not much of that wealth gets to the people of those countries. It's an exceptionally exploitive situation that's prevailing. And of course, when you have those kind of exploited conditions, the people that are having to succumb to this are inclined to rebellion. And so it's been the case both in Mali and also in Niger, that people have been trying to to fight for, if not more wealth from the mining operations coming back to the country, maybe even getting rid of them altogether. The uranium mines are quite polluting and dangerous for the workers that live in them. So that's been the history in Niger, and in the past 15 years, Niger has suffered 3 military coups against elected governments, so it's an extremely unstable but also authoritarian government in Niger that's totally in the back pockets of France and now of the United States. The Nigerian government is totally hostile to the Tuareg struggle, which in Niger is actually even more important than in Mali. About 10% of Niger's population are Tuareg. So, yeah, this is all these events in Niger are very, very tightly wound up with what's transpired in Mali with the intervention.
Yeah. Now, just quickly, kind of more touching on the talk you're going to be giving on Monday at 11 at University College at the University of Manitoba, 11:30 a.m. to 12:30. The Concourse Lounge. The talk is Ethics of Humanitarian Intervention, Mali and Haiti as a Test Case. Now, I guess in kind of giving the listener a bit of a primer on this, what are sort of these parallels that you're seeing between Haiti and Mali?
Yeah, that's certainly what drew me into the subject of Mali beginning a year ago. I just saw what was taking shape as something very similar to what we've seen in Haiti. You know, somewhat different reasons, but in both countries, there's a restive, rebellious population that's not happy or content with the conditions of poverty that are being imposed upon them and have been trying to do something about that. And the response that they've received in both countries has been to put down their struggles, their aspirations for social justice, for national sovereignty, and so on. And I think today in Mali we're seeing a bit of a repeat of the blueprint that was created in Haiti. Haiti's elected government was overthrown in a coup d'état in the year 2004. That was coup d'état was backed with essential aid and assistance from the United States, from France, also from Canada, as it turns out. And so what they put in place following the coup d'état in Haiti was a foreign military occupation regime, which had the rubber stamp approval of the United Nations Security Council. So that regime has been in place in Haiti ever since, and that's the real power in the country. That's precisely what they're putting in place in Mali today, so that France and the United States and the other European powers can sort of stand back a little bit and give the public the public face, the public image of this occupation won't be U.S. and French soldiers, but it will be soldiers drawn from some of the participating African countries. And then the other thing that's being prepared now in Mali is a rushed election, so that with a lot of international money coming into the country, they can essentially buy the election result that they wish. And that's, again, exactly what took place in Haiti following the earthquake in the 2010-2011 two-round election that brought Michel Martelly to the presidency in Haiti. So some very striking parallels going on in the two countries of, you know, what will be, what has been in Haiti and what will be in Mali, a long-term military political occupation to take and maintain control of the country.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to remind the listeners, Monday, the February 25th, 11:30 to 12:30, Roger Anderson will be giving a talk at the University of Manitoba at University College in the Concourse Lounge. Talking about the ethics of humanitarian intervention, Mali and Haiti as test cases. Now, also, Roger, with your writings and things like that, where can people access your writings and stuff on Mali and on Haiti?
Yeah, so you mentioned earlier, I've been publishing articles on rabble.ca, and I've created a page on my blog, rogeranis.com, a page devoted to Mali, where I've brought together what I think are the most significant and important writings on Mali that are being done by writers around the world. So listeners will find a pretty comprehensive resource page there of articles on Mali as well, including some of which I've written, but perhaps more importantly, other writers that have been perhaps at this even longer than I have. So that's a good source as well, the Mali page at rogerannis.com.
Yes, wonderful. Well, thank you very much, Roger, and I encourage listeners to go out and to go out to the talk and find out more about all this, because you know, as we kind of talked about, and it's something that I've been and on the show that I've been kind of harping on, is really the silence on Canadian foreign policy. It's either that we're the Dudley Do-Rights of the world, or we're just tagging along with the bully, the United States, when that's really not the case. And there's lots of other things going on with Canadian foreign policy, like you mentioned in this interview about the effect of Canadian mining companies, and specifically in Africa, and what kind of effect that has. So as always, I thank you for coming on and bringing up these issues and bringing your analysis and research.
You're welcome. It's been good talking to you and to your listeners.
Yes. Well, thank you very much. And hopefully I'll talk to you soon, Roger. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Roger Annis. So he is the coordinator for the Canada-Haiti Action Network. They do good work. And like you said, I mean, Haiti's one of those things that you don't hear a lot about in Canada. And Canada has huge involvement there. And somewhat dubious as well, depending on how you want to look at it. But there's a lot of stuff there. If you look up Canada Haiti Action Network, it's a great website. And like you said, rogerannis.com, he has a bunch of stuff on Mali. So I definitely encourage the listeners to go out and look at all that. Now we're going to take a quick break. There'll be a message here for you, and then we'll also be hearing a bit of music. At the start of the show, you heard a song by Propagandhi called Today's Empires, Tomorrow's Ashes, off of the album of the same name. I thought it was very fitting. And now, because we're talking about Mali, again, I will play some more. I really like this stuff. This is Tinnerim. They are from Northern Mali, musicians. So hear more of that with a little bit of a break. So this is Warning Shots. My name is Scott Price. Warning Shots is CKW's independent international news show. Take a bit of a break. And of course, if you've been listening, questions, comments, concerns, you can phone me right now. You can 204-774-6877. But Warning Shots, I will be back in a moment. The number again to phone, 204-774-6877.
Hey, did you hear? CETA will create $12 billion in new wealth and put $1,000 into the pockets of every working family, which is equivalent to creating 80,000 new jobs.
That story has long since been discredited since its appearance in 2008. The estimate seems dubious, as it assumes hypothetical conditions like zero unemployment and total reinvestment of trade gains into new production that just aren't realistic.
So what's the reality?
Canada already has a trade deficit with the EU. In a relationship where we export raw resources and import high-value manufactured goods, CETA will reinforce this inequity.
For more information on CETA, visit www.canadians.org. Let me try again.
I'm
Yes, and that was Tinarim off of their album, latest album, at least the latest album we have here of them, called Tassali, which I believe means water. And yeah, so they're a group of musicians from northern Mali. They are Touareg. Very interesting music. Now, I've talked about it before on the show, you know, sort of like this interesting desert blues rock, I guess. Very interesting stuff. And of course, just a little bit before the, of course, before the break, we had Roger Anison talking about the situation in Mali, as well as sort of the whole context there before the intervention, what the intervention is looking like now, the media coverage around it, as well as what's the situation in neighboring countries and in that whole area. You know, as you outlined, the French uranium mines that are in the area as well, what are the parallels to Haiti, and which he will be giving his talk on Monday at the University of Winnipeg and University College, in the Concourse Lounge, 11:30 to 12:30 a.m. So I hope if you can make it down there, and if not, go to Roger Annis. I believe it's rogerannis.com, his website. There's, like he said, there's a whole section on Mali. So go and check that out. It's a very important topic, and you know, I mean, like a lot of things, in a lot of issues that are happening in Africa today. You know, the coverage isn't that great, and you have to do some searching. I mean, if you're just going to turn on the CBC or whatever, you're probably not going to get really great coverage of it. So it's always good to go around and do some searching. And of course, with Roger Annis kind of giving you, like he said on his website, giving you a digest of those things, I think that that's important to start understanding. And then, you know, not necessarily that you read these things, you automatically have to agree with them, but read these things and then start saying, okay, start asking yourself some questions. And that's what I want to foster here on this show. So, so that was Warning Shots for today. And, let's get the theme going here. Right on. So that was Warning Shots for February the 22nd, 2013. It's your host, Scott Price. Like I was just saying, we had Roger Annis on. He's a coordinator for the Canada-Haiti Action Network, talking about Mali and its parallels to Haiti. So yeah, now as far as the next couple weeks, things are in flux. I'm really hoping I'm going to try to put together a show next week, a kind of a tribute show to the late, great Bill Hicks. I believe it was end of, it's not his birthday, but kind of, I guess his death date is around end of February next week. So kind of a little tribute to Bill, and he's a big influence on me. For sure, and hopefully having maybe some local comedians on to kind of talk about Bill Hicks' legacy and that kind of stuff. So that's up in the air, but that's what I'm hoping to do for next Friday. Other stories I'm looking into, of course, Mali is something that I've been following for quite some time. Also on the docket for the next couple weeks, looking into the growth of very small-scale and low-powered radio stations in Central and South America. In a lot of cases, started by indigenous people down in Central and South America, starting up their own radio stations, and a lot of unions doing the same thing in that area. So talking about that and sort of the importance of what community radio and small-scale radio can do, and specifically in the situations in Central and South America. So that's another issue on a docket. As well. So those are some of the things you can expect for the next couple weeks on Fridays here on Warning Shots. Now, questions, comments, concerns, love to hear them. Office phone number 204-786-9782. That's 204-786-9782. Get a hold of our news director, Michael Welsh, CKUWnews@rockandmail.com. Get a hold of me, warningshots.ckuw959@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at warningshots. You can find me there. I also encourage you to follow CKUW on Twitter. That's a great resource to find out what's happening and the little things that are happening around the station, which make up the big part of what CKUW does. So there's all that information. So I hope to talk to you all next week, and it's supposed to be a nice weekend out there, so I hope you all enjoy your weekends. Go out there and be kind to one another, and I hope you have a safe and fun weekend, and I will talk to you all next week. Thank you again. This is Scott Price signing off. I'll talk to you next week. Thank you for listening. Of course, Mercy of Slumbers coming up, and then of course the Community Cupboard, so stay tuned. Keep it locked here on CKUW 95.9 FM.
Grab yourself a pen and some paper. It's time for CKW's Community Cupboard. Announcements and resources from and in your community. If you have a public service announcement or community resource to share, contact us at 786-9782 or email ckuw@uwinnipeg.ca.
And here is your community cupboard for today. The Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization of Manitoba, also known as IRCOM, is looking for positive role models to act as mentors to youth participating in their after-school programming. So the successful youth mentors will work with newcomer youth 13 to 18 and provide them with educational and social support. So to apply for this position, you have to be over 18 years old, speak English or French, and one of the following languages: Swahili, Aramaic, Arabic, Somali. Possess a minimum of high school diploma or equivalent. Be committed to developing and sustaining a positive relationship with a youth mentee for a minimum of 12 months and willing to sign a contract to this effect. Able to actively provide a newcomer youth with support related to school, career choices, advice on how to live successfully. Youth mentors will be giving a $100 honorarium per month for their participation in the program. For information on all of this, for question, called Wade Park, phone number 204-943-